The recent release of hundreds of classified documents, thousands in fact, containing information that was obviously not meant for our eyes, made the idea of talking about spying seem like a perfect topic for this week's Please Explain. And we've enlisted two leading experts. Thomas S. Blanton is director of the National Security Archive, an independent non-governmental research institute and library at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He filed his first Freedom of Information request in 1976 when he was a cub reporter in Minnesota, and he's been filing them full-time with the National Security Archive since 1986. Also with us is Joseph Weisberg, who worked in the Central Intelligence Agency's Directorate of Operations in the early 1990s. He's written on intelligence matters for the New York Times and the Washington Post, and he's the author of two novels, most recently An Ordinary Spy. Welcome to our show.
Really nice to be with you, Leonard.
And a reminder that we'll be taking your calls later. Our number here is 646-829-3985. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Tom, can you tell us a bit about the history of spying in the United States? And I remember reading that in his very first presidential State of the Union address, George Washington requested that Congress establish a Secret Service Fund for clandestine activities. Did they do that?
They did, about $1 million worth. And Washington had quite a lot of experience before that, getting information from folks. Remember Nathan Hale? And there were spies going both ways in the Revolutionary War, and Washington depended on them to understand where the British troop movements were. We've come a long way since then. One author of a recent book about the National Security Agency, which is probably the biggest of the spying agencies in the United States, said, you know, before World War II, the entire bugging, wiretapping, foreign intelligence signals operation of the United States could fit probably into one room. And today, it's the equivalent of an entire city out here at Fort Meade, Maryland, with 20,000 employees and tens of billions of dollars of budget and hundreds of satellite dishes and whole huge buildings just devoted to this particular pastime.
But it ebbed and flowed over history. There was a lot of spying during the Civil War. There was fair amount during the Spanish-American War, World War One. But no official intelligence agency during the first half of the 20th century until the OSS was created during World War II.
Yes, but at the same time, each of the military services did have their intelligence officers. That was well understood from George Washington on through World War II that they were supposed to gather information for their leaders. And that's actually how the Central Intelligence Agency came about, because Presidents Roosevelt and Truman particularly saw the turf wars between the military services and even the diplomats, the State Department, and said, you know, that's one of the problems here, this lack of sharing of information or the lack of a central, independent agency that just would report to the president. So we got to create one, and that's the birth of the Central Intelligence Agency right after World War II.
Joseph, what's meant by intelligence? Is intelligence always information that can't be asked for straightforwardly, but rather can only be obtained through subterfuge?
That is the general idea, that intelligence is secret information and the only way to gain access to it is through spying. In practice, what does happen sometimes is a piece of information is gathered by actually asking somebody a question who answers it. And once you report that through secret channels, through the types of cables that we've been reading about, through WikiLeaks, but more on the CIA intelligence side, that would then also be referred to as intelligence.
But as Tom pointed out, we have a number of intelligence gathering services in our government. Why was there a need to create more? Wasn't the CIA enough?
Well, the CIA was focused on two particular areas from the time of its birth in 1947. One was what's called human intelligence, somewhat unfortunately abbreviated to HUMINT. And the idea of HUMINT is that you recruit foreign human beings, foreign sources, who spy for you and give you information. That's sort of always been the bread and butter of the CIA and how the CIA defined itself. The other area of espionage that the CIA has been deeply involved in forever is covert action. things like overthrowing foreign governments or these days killing terrorists. But once the technological ability came about to do sort of vast amounts of signals intelligence and things like that, it was really just too overwhelming and outside of the CIA's general expertise.
And by law, the CIA is at least, in theory, only allowed to do its intelligence gathering for things that are happening outside the country. The FBI handles domestic intelligence gathering.
Again, in theory. In practice, the CIA has always had presence in the United States and has a certain role that they are allowed to play. The CIA is allowed to recruit foreigners who are in the United States.
My guests are Joseph Weisberg and also Thomas S. Blanton. We're talking about espionage, intelligence gathering, and related matters on today's Please Explain. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Tom, the CIA is called an independent agency. What does that mean?
All that meant was, from President Truman's perspective, that it wasn't beholden to the military services, who all fought with each other about their budgets and their turf, and it wasn't beholden to the State Department, where Truman also had his problems. And so the idea was it would be an independent agency reporting to the president. Now, what the 9/11 Commission ultimately found was the CIA had its own turf wars, for example, with the FBI, and didn't share information that might have caught a couple of the hijackers before the 9/11 events. And so a new shuffling of the deck chairs was done by Congress and the creation of a new Director of National Intelligence, DNI, under whom the CIA is and under whom the rest of the intelligence community is supposed to be. It's unclear whether that organizational chart change has made a huge amount of difference to date. And there's very much a cultural, I think, difference among the various agencies that Joe Weisberg could probably speak more to than I do. But you know, you have this Signals Intelligence Agency, National Security Agency, the wiretap folks. You got the Geospatial Intelligence Agency, that the ones who look at the spy satellite photos and the overflight photos. You've got the intelligence divisions of each of the military services. You got the overall Pentagon's Intelligence Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency that runs the attachés that are in all the embassies around the world. You got parts of the FBI, you got parts of the Treasury. It's a pretty extraordinary array of agencies, each with their own zealously guarded turf and missions and separations, and it's been a real struggle, I think, particularly recently, get them all to work together.
Well, Joe, there's another side to independent. The implication is that it's free of political pressure, but we've heard throughout the years that that's never been the case, and now there's this new movie, Fair Game, that once again reminds us that the CIA was not immune to bowing to political pressure. Would it be possible for the CIA to remain totally independent?
I think not. It makes me think of journalism in general and the fight we always come back to, the way that Keith Olbermann was recently suspended, because there's an idea that journalists should not in any way have their political views come out, but we know that they've got them. So are they really independent, or are they pretending to be independent? Officers at the CIA have their political views. It can't help but color the way they behave and the way they act and the way they carry out their mission.
Although for a long time, those political views were colored by the Cold War, and then the Cold War ended. So what happened to the culture of the CIA?
Well, it's a good question. I left not long after the Cold War ended, so I'm not exactly sure.
I'm sure you're still in touch with some of your old friends.
Yeah, to some degree. I mean, there seems to be a popular perception that may be right, that an organization that was right of center has now shifted and become left of center, that they were.
Although it started off, in theory, many people felt it was a left of center organization in 1945 or 46, whenever it was formed.
Yeah, I think that perception didn't last very long. It didn't take too many decades of overthrowing foreign governments and whatnot before it became seen by many people as kind of reactionary.
James Jesus Angleton and others.
Yes. Although I don't know if Angleton's problem was so much being reactionary as being insane.
Did you know him?
No. He was long dead by the time I got there.
And his orchids, too.
Right.
A New York Times reviewer, speaking of your book, An Ordinary Spy, said that the CIA you described had the culture of a bank in Cleveland.
Right.
Was that an accurate insight?
Yes, I loved that. I loved that line. Another line that I liked recently, there's a recently retired CIA officer who's writing under the pseudonym I I think it's Ishmael Jones, who has written a book, and he was talking about the CIA culture, and he said that the way to understand the CIA is that it's a Soviet-style organization. And I think it's the same point. It is a bureaucracy, and the level of bureaucracy is startling.
Well, some people can be open about working for the agency, but others are forced to live double lives because they work covertly. Do they integrate?
Well, generally speaking, the analysts are not undercover and have no need to be, and the people who serve abroad spying for the U.S. government are undercover. At headquarters, everybody knows each other and mixes fine, and there isn't too much trouble. So I would say they integrate.
And then when they go home, the covert ones have to make believe that they're working for some other place. What were you, covert or?
I was covert. It's an interesting thing you bring up. The other place that you usually say you work for is considered classified. So even though everybody knows it, and you could look it up on Google and find it out in 5 seconds, I'm not allowed to say what it is. But I can say that I pretended to work there for a long time.
Tom, some people...
And in the old days, most of the CIA officers abroad were actually undercover as diplomats at U.S. embassies. And that, I think, might get us to some of today's conversation.
I was just about to get you there. I was going to say some people were shocked by the WikiLeaks revelations that diplomats engage in spying. But hasn't there been a long history of spies working undercover as diplomats, or at least working within the diplomatic missions?
Right, but that's also one of the big criticisms, particularly in the 1990s and particularly after 9/11, that too many spies were just hanging out at embassy cocktail parties and not actually doing the work, say, under cover of a private economic, outfit or company that would give them access to sectors of a foreign economy or a foreign state that wouldn't connect with a diplomat or ever show up at the embassy. So there's definitely been a push inside the agency and from the intelligence committees on Capitol Hill for more officers to work undercover in other roles than diplomats. Now, it's an interesting dynamic over time for the diplomats, because in the early years of diplomacy, they were all lifting whatever they could lift from their opposing countries' representatives. And that changed over time as diplomats tried to professionalize their occupation, and culminated in that 1961 Convention on Diplomatic Relations, which says, effectively, gentlemen don't steal other gentlemen's mail. And so as diplomats got out of the business in order to elevate their own status and be more formal and not get their hands dirty, they became more like journalists, more like a good foreign bureau of a major newspaper. And the spies came in behind them with their tactical means and their undercover roles to fill in that that gap.
Now, you just mentioned gentlemen don't, you said steal, although Secretary of State Henry Stimson supposedly said gentlemen do not read each other's mail. And that's the way we've often heard things were done between the wars. But I suspect we were always reading each other's mail.
I suspect you're right. And I think today we're doing so on an industrial basis. I mean,
but were there any surprises in those WikiLeaks documents?
To me, I'm a student of American foreign policy, and we've collected millions of very similar documents from our Freedom of Information work over these 25 years we've been doing this. And, there's a big difference between what we do and what WikiLeaks did. It's sure a lot easier to get a thumb drive in an envelope with 1.6 gigabytes of leaked cables than it is to do the years of research and interviews and slogging through archives to file a good Freedom of Information request that actually produces a document down the road when you threaten the government with a lawsuit. So,
and then they black out stuff.
And they black out stuff. One of the things I loved about Joe's book was the way he used the blacked out block to have a verisimilitude about his narrative, because, so often what we see coming back from the government's got the blackout. Well, what's, I think, most interesting on the diplomatic cables is they're very granular. They give you a lot of detail. In cables like from the meetings with Chinese leaders, you're getting kind of unvarnished quotations from top Chinese leaders that they would probably never otherwise have out in the light of day. So there's a kind of a reduction of their power, in a sense, by that transparency. On the other hand, it very clearly makes the life of the diplomats way harder. Some of those ambassadors are going to have to leave those countries because nobody in those governments will want to see them. But, you know, as Secretary of Defense Gates the other day said, look, these countries are going to keep talking to us because it's in their interest to talk to us. So this is really not going to do the huge damage. Don't hyperventilate about it. It's a problem, but please don't hyperventilate. So that was interesting to me. And it's a different kettle of fish than the work that, say, Joe did when he was a covert officer abroad, because in a number of the cables, the diplomats are saying, you know, protect this name because somebody's talking candidly who has some good reason to know. But many of these cables are just records of official conversations of ordinary business, and they're not – nobody needs to be protected. Nobody's really being put at risk. It's just basic reporting. So to that extent, not – earth-shattering, but some really interesting granular detail, and I think students of relations between the United States and those countries are going to be pouring through these materials probably for years to come. It may take them years to get them all up on the web. There are only about 700 or 800 of them actually on the web. It's not really a dump yet. It's a dribble.
I just want to say that I enjoyed the cable that said that Canada is wary of us and a little jealous of our success.
Yeah, my favorite one was the Dagestani wedding with the boiled sheep carcasses being dumped onto tables with every new guest who came in the door. I thought that cable was brilliant. I thought the New York Times ought to offer that diplomat a job. That's one of the most colorful, wonderful, witty, and in-depth understanding levels upon levels of ethnic divisions in Dagestan. I just thought it was just a brilliant piece of reportage.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we invite our listeners to join in the conversation. Our number here is 646-829-3985. That's 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are Thomas S. Blanton, Director of the National Security Archive, which is an independent non-governmental research institute and library at George Washington University, and Joseph Weisberg, who worked in the CIA's Directorate of Operations in the early 1990s and has written about intelligence matters for publications like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and he also has written two novels, I guess, in which you can tell more, speak more truthfully than you can if you just try to write a nonfiction memoir. The most recent one is called An Ordinary Spy. Again, the number is 646-829-3985. We're back with Joseph Weisberg, now a novelist, but formerly with the Central Intelligence Agency's Directorate of Operations, and Thomas S. Blanton, Director of the National Security Archive at George Washington University. Our number here, 646-829-3985. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And George in Brooklyn asks, what are the common misconceptions of espionage held by the public? Other than you didn't have as many beautiful women and wear a tuxedo as often as James Bond, I guess.
Right, just once a week. Well, I think the biggest misconception is that it works. I don't believe myself that it really, at the end of the day, is possible to recruit foreigners to spy for the United States who will provide us with secret information that will actually help us set policy or protect us.
It did in the past, didn't it? Weren't there people in the Soviet Union who were disaffected who actually provided the CIA with a lot of valuable information?
Well, this is, of course, a matter of opinion, but I don't think so, no. We know at this point who most of the Soviet spies were because most of them were executed. They were betrayed by Ames and Hansen, and they once they were executed, the CIA didn't hold the information about them so tightly, so we can look at who they are. A lot of them were KGB officers, and the information they provided was all about the sort of spy game. We tried to find out from them who they had that had penetrated the CIA and vice versa. And none of it really had much impact on policy or anything significant about our national security. There were others who did other things. For example, in the scientific realm, there was a very famous one named Tolkachev, who gave us information about Soviet aircraft design. And he's considered maybe the premier CIA spy of the era. I'm not sure the information mattered.
But there were people who spied for the Soviet Union who gave them a lot of valuable information.
Well, they did get information about the atom bomb. I guess I can't really discount that one going that far back. But during the rest of the Cold War, I'm not so sure.
So, Tom, do you agree with Joe that the CIA is less effective than we'd like to believe, considering the fact that we pour billions of dollars into it on year after year after year? Tom, are you there?
Yes, I'm right here.
Yeah.
I think the reason we pour those billions in may actually help support Joe's point, which is that other people do it, so we've got to do it. And it gets that kind of spy versus spy Mad Magazine quality to it when you look at who actually gets damaged. I posed this same question, Leonard, to one of the CIA agents, officers, Sam Halpern, who had risen to very high levels in the operations side, had been key in a lot of the Cuba policy, Operation Mongoose. And I said, Sam, tell me, can you point to a single human asset that ever made a real difference at the highest level? Sure, there's lots of human assets that produce lots, say, some technical data, some like Penkovsky, some military plans, even Kuklinski, the great Polish spy who gave us the martial law plans for Poland, didn't make much difference in terms of what we did about it. But Sam, could you tell me one who made a real difference? And he could point to one from his 25-year career who he said made a difference, and it was a hotel person in Havana who sent a written alert and then got himself out of the country to Florida and was debriefed in 1962, who was actually the eyewitness who saw one of the medium-range missiles, Soviet missiles, being shipped down the street and could help the CIA locate them to send a U-2 spy plane over to photograph them to give the president weeks of advance notice before Khrushchev intended to spring those on an unsuspecting world. So that made a major difference, helped set off a huge crisis, arguably gave the U.S. the initiative in the whole situation. But there are relatively few of those kinds of examples of the human intelligence impact, and that's been always one of the complaints about the agency, even from its strong backers on Capitol Hill who appropriate those billions of dollars, is where's the Taliban penetration? You know, where's the American asset who's inside an al-Qaeda cell? Where was an intelligence asset even inside the Kremlin? I mean, Ronald Reagan once commented that he learned more from sitting down with Mikhail Gorbachev himself than he had learned from all the CIA briefings about Gorbachev. And, you know, I think that's probably true.
Now, in theory, Joe, do members of intelligence agencies have a code of ethics? And is it different for different agencies? The CIA was willing to engage in what many consider to be torture to elicit information after 9/11, but the FBI says it prefers less coercive techniques.
That's a tough question to answer. I found that by personality type, CIA officers tended to be very straight arrows, not so much the cowboy type that we hear about, but people who literally did not like to drive over the speed limit. But give them the authority to do something else during the war on terror, and it apparently wasn't that hard to find people who were willing to do it, too.
Well, who winds up working for the CIA? I would assume the NSA gets different people because they're number crunchers. But in the old days, at least in England, they would go to Cambridge and Oxford and only look for the richest and the best educated, and that hurt them
right,
ultimately, because many of those people wound up becoming spies for the Soviet Union. What about the CIA? Did they initially recruit people from Harvard and Yale and the other Ivy League schools?
They did. The CIA initially was run almost completely by Ivy League graduates, but that's changed completely. And now every really sector of the country and every college in the country is well represented at the CIA.
Well, who did they approach you or did you approach them?
I approached them, in my case, I think for the same reason that the majority of us approached them, which is we had fantasies of being James Bond, and it took too long to figure out that that wasn't very realistic. So in my case, I called them up. They're listed. You can call them, and they send you a job application like any other bureaucracy. And
they even have a recruitment video. You know, you
can right, their website's great.
Yes, exactly.
Should we take some calls?
Sure.
Michael from Park Slope. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, thanks. I had a question regarding the whole WikiLeaks thing for your guests and whether they bought the whole story that one seemingly lower mid-level intelligence officer was actually able to download, a 250,000 documents from such a variety of sources. And
it's only from one source. That's the problem.
He got information on every country and all these through one.
Yeah, it was one network called CIPRNet, which was created after 9/11 as part of the information sharing process so that military folks on the ground would be able to look in the cable traffic. It's a good theory, and it's an interesting, from what we know and what The Guardian and The New York Times has reported, it was a single thumb drive with 1.6 gigabytes on it that was sent by this guy Bradley Manning to WikiLeaks, and another version of that given to The Guardian. So, and it's a 251,000 cables sounds like a huge amount, but it's a small fraction of the total cable traffic that goes on in a given year. And, you know, even an individual embassy can produce 1,000 to 10,000 cables a year, depending on how much is going on. A single CIA station can produce, you know, thousands of cables if they're really active. So this is a subset of what was available, and one of the mysteries is how did he select the subset? What were his search terms on this CIPRNet? To actually run a search on the CIPRNet only takes a matter of seconds. To download, as he apparently described to some fellow a hacker type, it took him all night to download onto CDs. And if you think about that, do a Google search, that only takes seconds. But if you want to download your results, yes, that can take hours or all night. And that's pretty much what seems to have happened.
Yeah, I have no trouble believing it either. I believe almost anything about a bureaucracy, and that I believe easily.
Do we have CIA or do we have intelligence officers everywhere? Would we have them in Togo and Fiji as well as in France and
there are a few types of questions I try to avoid because they get uptight about certain things. I don't want to answer that one, but I think Tom will.
Yes, is the answer, I think. But the intelligence community, like everybody else, has to set priorities. So you wouldn't have very many intelligence officers in a place like Fiji unless an arms dealer like Victor Bout or Boot was moving weapons through there. Then you could have a whole bunch of intelligence operatives there. So there's a priority-setting process, and it occurs through all the agencies. I think one of the shocking things we found from some of the documents about Saddam Hussein, for example, is that when they needed to debrief Saddam Hussein after he was captured, there were only about 12 FBI agents, for example, who were considered native fluency in Arabic. And one of them, who had been born in Lebanon, was sent over to sit in Saddam's cell and drink tea with him, and over time got some fascinating information. Like, you know, finally the guy asked Saddam, and this is great intelligence gathering, I have to say, and he says to Saddam, so you knew you didn't have any weapons of mass destruction. Why didn't you just tell us? You could have headed off the invasion. Saddam says to him effectively, gosh, if I had announced that I didn't have them anymore, the Iranians would have invaded me. And all of a sudden, you get a much better sense of the internal dynamics of why Saddam would go to such lengths to dissemble and lie about his own weapons of mass destruction in such a way that we over here in Washington or the Bush administration would take it as evidence that he was hiding some, right? So you get good intelligence gathering. Didn't take any torture. It took actually sitting on the rug with the guy and drinking tea and gaining his confidence and speaking the language. And that's one place where we've been quite deficient as a country.
Joe?
I was going to say, I think there's a story from that war that also highlights why the type of intelligence gathering Tom is talking about might be more likely to work than actually recruiting and running spies. There was a very high-placed member of Saddam's inner circle who started working for the CIA before the Iraq War, who told the CIA that Saddam did not have weapons of mass destruction. So in a way, it was the dream agent. It's what you fantasize about. You have somebody at the top in a position to know who's willing to work for you and tells you exactly what you need to know. But it suffered from one problem.
He was telling the wrong story.
It's more than nobody believed his story, right? How do you know if he's telling the truth or not? Because had he been a plant, he would have said the same thing. And so there's no way really to determine if your agents are plants or not.
But isn't part of the problem of analyzing any of this intelligence what you believe might be the truth or might not be the truth. And if you believe that Saddam Hussein is building atomic bombs, even if Joseph Wilson says he's not, then you believe that he's going to try to build an atomic bomb.
That's exactly right. So once again, what's the point of the billions of dollars and the effort and the risk taken to get somebody to tell you something you won't listen to anyway?
Just one more caller. Carol, South Salem?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead. Quickly.
No, many, many years ago, I had a friend who was a cultural attaché, excuse me, frog in my throat, first in a country in Africa and then later in Pakistan, and he was a, quote, cultural attaché. And I have heard that cultural attaché is really just kind of a euphemism for spying and information gathering. And I'm wondering if that's true or if...
Do we actually have attachés who are interested in culture? Joe?
Well, that's what I'm wondering.
Okay. We're going to ask Joe right now.
Tom, if you take that one too, I'll send you a small gift.
In the past, yes, some cultural attachés have been spies, but it's by no means a one-to-one correlation. And in fact, I'd say today it would be pretty unlikely for a cultural attaché to be a spy, because to be a cultural attaché, you go to art openings, you deal with musicians and others. You're not going to be in touch with people who have the kind of political or economic or military information that is what Washington wants to consume. So the covers today tend to be much more in, say, private, corporate, or international trade arenas, where you get in touch with all kinds of folks, like indigenous industries, militaries, and diplomats. It tends to be that kind of approach, because...
Tom, we have to leave it there, unfortunately. Thank you so much, both of you. Thomas S. Blanton of the National Security Archive at George Washington University, and Joseph Weisberg, whose latest novel is An Ordinary Spy. I hope another one's coming soon.